Before we begin this very special Thanksgiving episode of Daddy Issues, listeners, we wanted to take a moment to thank those of you who have generously reviewed us on iTunes. They're such nice reviews. We appreciate them. And they also help us enormously when it comes to Apple Podcasts. Some of our favorites include a review from Laura Carney that said, "I couldn't stop listening to this show. I started listening to an early episode and then 5 minutes later, I lost track of all time because the insights and life experiences of the guests are so fascinating while the hosts keep the stories relatable. Highly recommend. Their episodes about Mad Men are excellent and funny too." Another review that I really liked: "Fascinating. People from vastly different backgrounds discuss their daddy issues with hosts who are essentially unlicensed therapists raised by Oscar Wilde and Dorothy Parker." I'll take that. That's nice. Sure. Also, we want to thank our Patreon patrons, just a few of whom include Betsy Lerner, AJ Delario, and Christian Sky Olsen. Without you, we would be stuck with oppressive mounting invoices for all the online software we use and the discordant feeling that we're shouting into a dark canyon. You too can support this podcast by going to patreon.com/tellmeaboutyourfather, where for as little as $3 a month, you'll get access to our exclusive series, The Monthly Daily Dads, in which we look at some of the month's most absurd and intriguing dad-centric stories that appeared in the iconically frenetic and celeb-obsessed Daily Mail. If you prefer not to, and you just like to keep it free and easy, we're not mad. In fact, we're extremely grateful that you're listening to this right now. So with that, let's get going. Welcome to Tell Me About Your Father, Daddy Issues, where we discuss who or what in recent pop culture and current events is and is not our dad right now. This is a very special Thanksgiving-themed episode of Daddy Issues, so we will be serving up plate after plate of traditional Americana and cultural discourse fare topped with industrial fried onions, and then we will drink until the football comes on and we slip into a coma, all in the name of gratitude. I am Matthew Philp.
And I'm Elizabeth Thompson. Our guest today comes with talent and humor as abundant and runneth over as a Thanksgiving cornucopia. Writer Maggie Sirota has worked as managing editor for the beloved news and internet culture site Death and Taxes, and later as a staff writer at Spin Magazine. She's worked at Tumblr and also as a contributor to Glamour Magazine, Refinery 29, Rolling Stone, and Pitchfork, among many other titles. If you're not following Maggie on Twitter, get thee to Twitter right now and smash the follow button on @MaggieSirota for her hilarious tweets. These tweets include Maggie's screenshots of conversations with her father about the family dogs, and rather frequently, a photo of a shirtless Sting playing a lute while his wife, Trudy Styler, does yoga next to him. Listener, this image will take your breath away. Maggie shares it regularly. We're going to talk to her more about Sting in a second. Welcome to Daddy Issues, Maggie.
Thanks for having me. Wow, you got my credits right. Wow.
Did people get them wrong?
Yeah. Have you been? No, it's more so like, tell me what you've written for, or like, tell me what you've done.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
The okay, lazy did we thing. Not know each other? Have we not been friends for years?
Right. Yeah.
Do I not tell you about my job and my hopes and my dreams and my failures? Oh, okay.
You know, we like to do the work here at Tell Me About Your Father. Matt, welcome back.
Thank you.
For listeners at home, has been on hiatus for the past few months as he recovered from gallbladder surgery.
That's true. I did. It was so much weirder than I thought it would be. Like, you're just like, oh, I can't walk up a hill without needing a 2-hour nap. It was like, it was this incredibly bizarre experience. Thank you to Medicaid for paying for that, by the way. My God. New York State. You ever want to get sick anywhere? New York City and New York State is the place to do it.
The American healthcare system is not our dad, is it, Matt?
It's not. Well, it was my dad this time because I was at NYU Langone. I had like the business class, everything, and I didn't get a bill because I like was unemployed for like last year and only freelancing, and which meant that I qualified for Medicaid. So I had this whole thing and I never saw a bill. I was like, my God, I feel like I'm in Europe.
Well, we're glad that you're feeling better, Matt.
Thank you. And thank you for you guys for doing such a magnificent job I meant it when I said the thing about The Sopranos. Your series was extraordinary.
To our guest, Maggie, and to our listeners at home, Aaron and I, our co-host who's not joining us today, just got done with what was supposed to be a two-part series on The Sopranos that we turned into a seven-part series. There's just so much daddy stuff on the show.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. AJ alone, you can have a whole series.
Oh, my God. don't worry. There's like hours devoted to AJ between these seven episodes.
Oh, perfect. Wonderful.
I have noticed on your Twitter feed, at the risk of, you know, crazy Twitter stalker, which I kind of am, I guess, because I'm always like, I just like spend a lot of time on your Twitter feed today, but I always see you in my feed.
You know what? Lucky for you, I love attention.
Good. Regardless, but you have been recently rewatching The Sopranos, which I appreciate, and tweeting about it. And I do share your love for Polly Walnuts.
Oh my God.
I'm not supposed to love him, but I really love him. He's so funny and so.
Well, I think that's kind of the thread through all the characters, right? We're not supposed to love any of them.
Yeah.
You know, David Chase loves to kind of be antagonistic of his audience. I think he's almost a little mad that people love some of these characters.
Yeah, he seems to be both. I feel like make up your mind, David Chase, because he. Yeah. It's like he wants to remind you over and over again that these are like unlovable, psychopathic murderers. But then, you know, it's like filled with comedy and filled with emotion and very relatable things. So how could you not fall in love with these people? Seems like.
Yeah, exactly. That's kind of the problem is that like Tony has this very like compartmentalized life and he can't be a whole person to his family, to society, because like he does things that are unspeakably evil.
Mm-hmm.
Like. You know, and he would argue in service of his family.
Yeah, right. He's just taking care of business.
Like, I've never really bought the kind of thread line that he was a sociopath at towards the end when like Cooperberg and Melfi are talking about like how you can't reform a sociopath. I feel like that's kind of a cop out to call him a sociopath.
Because
it's almost like he doesn't have agency or there aren't outside factors. It's just like he's someone that grew up out of a certain era. Like, he's a leader. Like, he's. In a way, charismatic and talented, but it's like he's using it for something.
Yeah, he's a mobster. I guess the question is, can one be a violent killer and a mobster without being a sociopath? We did a lot of the shows with Matt Zollersites, who wrote, you know, a huge book about The Sopranos, and Alan Sepinwall from Rolling Stone, and he talked a lot about, you know, The Sopranos is challenging for people to wrap their head around because it asks the viewer to accept that like many realities are true at once. You know, Tony is horrible and you love him.
Yeah, people love Obama. He's a war criminal. Like,
let's talk about drones. Uh-huh. Let's talk about the drones, Obama.
You know what I mean? Yeah. I mean, for me, I think the main argument against him being a sociopath is I don't think he would even be like in treatment. Like, he obviously experiences guilt. Like, it comes through in his dreams.
100%. He wouldn't have gone to a therapist in the first place. Yeah.
Damn it. We need to go back and re-record all this.
We should do the entire thing from the beginning.
With Maggie. Yeah. Well, Maggie, when I am gently stalking your Twitter feed, one thing that I've noticed over the years is your amazing screenshots of text messages that you have, texting exchanges you have with your father, often about the family dogs. Recently, there was a photo that maybe he thought was lit a little lighter, but it's just like a dark room with two glowing eyes in it.
Yeah, that's a common. So my dad like spends most of his time in his little den, kind of a basement. Not a lot of light gets in. And he's a flip phone. He's, you know, a 63-year-old man with a flip phone. He doesn't want to hear about iPhones. He doesn't like, don't even say that to him. Like, he doesn't even like the fact that he has to have a cell phone, but he has one.
Yeah.
And so, like, at any given time, he's a pack of four Rottweilers, and they're kind of like Menudo, where, like, you know, like one, you know, like a Menudo when you hit 18, like, you know, like one, you get cycled out, and then another, you know, like another member comes in. Well, like, in this pack, like, if one passes away, then another Rottweiler or a pair get brought in. So there's usually four.
What are their names?
So right now, there's Banjo and Ivy. And they're siblings. And then the older two are James Brown and Ella.
Fair.
And did your dad, does his kind of his world, like, or his main focus on these dogs at all times?
Yeah, it's so funny. He's like, do you love daddy? Daddy loves you. You love your daddy? Yes, you do. Yes, you do. Like, that is like, my dad used to own a music store, and it was funny to listen to the employees make fun of him, and they would do the, do you love your daddy? Do you love your daddy?
Would he bring the dogs to the music store?
Oh, yeah. People would freak out because they're Rottweilers. And I was like, no, they're loving and wonderful. And like, the thing about Rottweilers, they look scary, but they just kind of want to love you to death.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're
quite elegant.
When I walk into my dad's house, like 400 pounds of dog comes running at me, and they're real happy to see me.
I've never met a Rottweiler that wasn't just incredibly sweet and like giant, like sea lion.
Yeah. These are very sweet. They're sweet. Like, the only thing is, like, they love me too much. Like, I want them to, like, love me a little less.
It's smothering you. It's the
teeth. Yeah, I gotta keep, like, things up high. Like, you gotta.
Yeah. Did he always have these dogs? Did you have dogs growing up?
I'm a cat person. So I have I usually had a cat growing up, but my parents didn't live together. So, like, he usually had a dog since I was a teenager. There was Harley. I'm gonna shout out all the dead dogs. Pour some out for the ones that are no longer with us. But he had Harley, the giant black lab, and then Hobbs, his first Rottweiler, who then had the leg amputated because of cancer. But it was really cute. I mean, watching him hobble around as a tripod was really cute. It sounds horrible to say. I'm not going to lie. Like, he had to do a little spin to get up the one step to get back in the house. to get the momentum.
There's a dog near me that does that. And the dog's obviously just figured out a system. It's gone, I've got three legs or whatever. This is how I just get her around like that now. Yeah.
Yeah. He was like a really, was also on steroids because he had Addison's disease. So he's like this giant muscular sausage on three legs. And then he just spin around and like, if you laughed, like, he just bark at you because he's very serious and he doesn't like when people have fun. But that dog was great. I love that dog. He was like my favorite.
What else does your dad text you about besides dogs, or is it only dog content?
So my dad's text usually like every couple of weeks, like a paragraph will come through, and it's like it follows like a certain there is a formula. Mm-hmm. So it's usually like if there was a weather related event, a storm, like what the damage cost him. And then, or if one of the dogs had to go to the dog hospital, what that cost them. Then an update on the deer he's making friends with and his way he's feeding them. And like, I'm really glad he's making friends.
The deers have names?
I don't think so, but he feeds them because he lives on 20 acres of land. And he said like hunters have like asked him if they can come hunt on his property. And he's like, no, those are my friends.
That's cool. That's sweet.
That is sweet. Your dad is like Snow White with the flip phone.
Yeah.
You know, all the birds sing, and he's like, yeah, I'll be listening to Led Zeppelin, and all the birds come around and like help put on his flannel shirt and his,
they help him put on
sneaker, his like what big white puffy sneakers and dad jeans.
Incredible. Yeah. Weather techs are huge for parents and dads.
Yeah.
Like, just their weather and also weather where you are, where their children
are. Yeah.
That's a big
one. I think, like, a big thing for them is, like texting. What's something my dad used to do when I lived in Philly was text me about a violent crime that happened months ago, nowhere near me.
That's great. Yeah.
Like, he knew I worked at a coffee shop, so he'll, like, text me, like, a couple months after the fact about a holdup at another coffee shop that he thought maybe I worked there, and it's like, no.
Yeah, crimes that are nowhere near you, or like scary things that happen that are nowhere near you. I love that he does it months later too.
Yeah, I mean, my dad and I are kind of close in age, so sometimes it's kind of weird to like when he knows about things that I know about.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Because you're like, we're only got like a 20-year gap, and like most of my friends, they've got like a 40-year gap with their dad.
Interesting.
So I'll be like watching TV, and my dad will just like turn to me and go like, it's crazy that Dimebag Daryl got shot like that. And like dads aren't allowed to know about Dimebag Daryl.
Dad knows about, is he a Pantera fan? That's so interesting that he's not that much older than you in theory, you know?
Like, we were just watching metal videos one night, and he was talking, and I was talking to him about, like, I was talking about, like, I think, like, Bill Anselmo is just, like, sketchy politics or whatever. And he goes, and I just said to him, yeah, so the singer, and he goes, like, Phil Anselmo, dear. Like, he's telling me. Like, oh, please, tell me about Pantera, Dad.
Did you grow into that kind of thing? Because was it harder when he was younger and possibly like less mature? Was there like a tense period of time, or was it always kind of easygoing?
It was pretty easygoing. Like, he was kind of interested in things I liked.
Okay.
So he still like texts me jokes about Morrissey, even though I'm kind of turned on Morrissey in the last couple of years. Well, not a kind of. I did turn on Morrissey the past couple of years, but like, if he reads something somewhere about Morrissey, he'll text me about it.
I love that. Or, is that also a weird feeling to think about, like, when you were, so your dad was 20 when you were born?
Mm-hmm.
Like, when you were 18, he was, like, our age. Like,
yeah, it's crazy, about, like, right?
Yeah. Like, how, yeah. Like, how young they were. My mom had me when she was 32, but I'm, you know, I just turned 39, and I'm like, I remember my mom when she was my age. That's a weird, that's I think always a weird thing when you get old enough to be like, oh, I remember when my parents were my exact age right now.
Oh yeah, like when my dad turned like 30, he already had like two kids, you know, like it's just crazy.
Wow.
Was he always fine with it? Like, was he always like, this is great, I have two kids? Or was it like a difficult thing? Because he's like, I'm a kid and I want to go out and drink at bars.
Well, you kind of hit on an interesting thread there because like, I think drinking at bars was a habit he quit in his early 30s, like entirely. Okay. I think there were probably bigger issues than I'm a kid. I think it's more so drinking at bars is a problem.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of beloved musicians with questionable politics now, you mentioned Bill Anselmo and Morrissey. You pretty regularly tweet about Glenn Danzig. And
yeah.
Glenn Danzig is a very interesting person to me because of his, you know, influence on music. Like, the Misfits were an incredible band.
Hybrid Moments
is like a perfect song. Like, the melody, I just love it.
You get all your dirtbag friends in the car and you drive around and you're all singing She together. You're having a good time.
Then, you know, he kind of disappeared after, you know, Danzig and Mother and all of that. And there was a viral photo of him that, you know, came out, what, in the past decade, where he's grocery shopping and carrying a thing of freshed up kitty litter through the parking lot. So it's funny to think about Glenn Danzig with kitties at home. But you know, what else is going on with him? We recently had the comedy writer Alex Gordelis on, who we super briefly talked about Glenn. And I asked Alex if he was a Republican, if Glenn was a Republican, and he was like, I don't know. But then after that, I Googled Glenn and I found a quote about him referring to Planned Parenthood as a, quote, chop shop. So anyways, I just need to ask you, Twitter's foremost expert on Glenn Danzig, what's going on with him? Is he problematic, et cetera?
He's very problematic. And I'll tell you why. When I saw the Sam Hain reunion tour and he definitely used the F word to refer to someone when he was throwing them out of the show.
Oof.
And it was such a, like, I had an interview experience for the Village Voice go really bad with him when I asked him about a comment I thought was homophobic. And he got real combative with me and was like, it just ends with him cursing me out. But like, when, so this was after the fact, and like, I felt like vindicated, like I was absolutely right to ask that question. You know, felt good. I didn't pay money for that show. Like, I was like, my money didn't go to support that, but it really just like, I've never like really felt the same about him since.
Yeah, definitely. This is good.
Was he indignant about being called on it, or what was it?
Yeah. So the comment I asked about was about, like, he remarked at one point that he thought, like, there's this long time rumor that he was going to be like Wolverine in the X-Men movie instead of, like, that he was the director's first choice or something. He told LA Weekly that his Wolverine wouldn't have been as gay.
And the extent of Wolverine's gayness was the fact that the actor who played him was on Broadway in Oklahoma. Like, how was Wolverine, like, gay?
Yeah, what? Well, he wouldn't really answer that. Those were some great, you know, some questions I tried to ask. He got really combative, and, like, so then his manager, like, complained to my editor and just said, like, and said things that weren't true, that Glenn ended the interview early because I was asking inappropriate questions, which I feel like asking about, you know, a quote you've given on the record is a absolutely inappropriate question. I think I asked him if he thought that saying something like that would alienate his gay fans. I think is all reasonable questions.
1,000%. 1,000%.
Also, it's really cool when a manager just like picks up the phone and calls an editor, because that's when you know they're really in control of everything. Like, you're just like, oh, the manager's on the phone. I mean, obviously this journalist was out of line. It couldn't possibly be anything else. It couldn't possibly be that you're insane and unbalanced.
I love a frantic. I used to work at the Village Voice. Matt also worked at the Village Voice. You worked at the Village Voice. Like, we've all.
I was just a freelancer. I wasn't a staffer, but it was, a freelance assignment.
We've all worked in media, and there's nothing worse than the like frantic publicist or manager.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
That, you know, interview. And to Matt's point, like, it just always. I wish that managers and publicists of the world understood that that is the biggest tell that they're fucking terrified and that they know something really bad that's not the fault of the writer happened in the interview. Like, just don't say anything. Just don't call it all.
So I'll tell you guys the name of the actor off air, but kind of like just speaking on your like kind of publicist freak out, I was trying to get in touch with an actor for a story about a movie I grew up loving. And it wasn't a big deal. It was just like an anniversary piece for this movie. And for months, like, his publicist just said he's on vacation with his family, or she just wouldn't respond. So when I finally got in touch to be like, hey, some people talked about him, I'd like to give him a response, she like freaked out and act like I never like reached out to her, and somehow got my boss's cell phone number and started like texting her, who thankfully had my back, but was just like saying all these untrue things about me. It was just like,
oh my God.
Like, these people are so shameless.
Yeah.
They are shameless. And it always makes it worse. It's like, how do you think this is going to end for you or your clients? We're now even more interested in running a piece that starts with an editor's note about how shitty this person was during the interview.
It's not like you're going to HR. It's like, we're not in an office in some massive ludicrous bank where you can just, it's not the same thing calling the boss to complain and then there'll be some due process that'll be all very neat. Like, it's sort of,
like to speak to your manager, a writer, or a journalist. Doesn't work that way. Well, it's funny, when I worked at the Village Voice, it was my first job that I ever had. And the late great, he was a designer, L.D. Begthal. He was actually a musician. He was a member of the Magnetic Fields, and he was. And he also used to write music listings for the Village Voice. And I thought that, you know, and I edited that section of like the little calendar of like things to do in the city. And so Danzig was going to perform one night. And so LD was like, oh, I'm going to write up the little capsule, you know, thing about the upcoming show. And he describes Danzig as a, quote, pocket Adonis. And I had never heard that phrase before.
Incredible.
Because he's so short, right? And
he's like as tall as he is wide.
Yes, a pocket Adonis. But I was so stupid, and in a moment of bravery, went in and changed. I was like, this is clearly a typo. I've never heard the phrase pocket Adonis. So I changed it to pocket-sized Adonis.
Oh my God.
And later, it didn't go to print. But, you know, later I was doing layout with him because he was a designer. And he's like, what fucking idiot. An editorial changes the pocket size Adonis. And I just stayed quiet. I'm like, I don't know. Somebody.
I don't know. They sound like a dummy.
they don't know.
I'm not them.
Adonis. I sure hope someone got shot over that one. Yeah.
I love the fact that you brought up, like, you know, like a musician working in Alt Weekly, because I actually was commissioned to write a story for The Stranger, the Seattle Alt Weekly, by Sean Nelson, who was the lead singer of Harvey Danger.
Oh, yeah. It's Flagpole Sitta.
Yeah.
That's so cool. Wait, are you writing something for him?
Oh, no, this was in 2012. I just wrote an essay about why I love the show Hannibal in like in advance of its 3rd season premiere.
I wonder how many other musicians work in media now. I know that there's a fair amount of them, at least in marketing or like quietly working for like Spotify content teams or something.
Yeah. Like MC Search, I think, has like a branding agency or something.
Really interesting.
Yeah.
Quickly before we get into Matt's topics, Matt, I hate to keep you waiting, but
I love keeping you waiting.
We at this podcast are very interested in Travis Barker. Do you have thoughts in the like cognitive, like for me, I can't wrap my head around the fact that Travis Barker was in the Aquabats, a for listeners at home, semi-popular ska band in the 90s, and now he's like one of the most famous people in America. His career is amazingly long lasting. Like he's
he has like cred for someone who was kind of in a silly ska band.
Yes. Do you have any opinions about him or?
Okay. See, I have like this really broken like charisma tracker because I'm not a Blink-182 fan. I'm just like, I think I was just too old for pop punk when it happened. But like, if I had to pick one that I thought would be the star, I think it'd be like Tom because he's like the cute one. Or like.
Absolutely.
Or like Mark, or Mark because he's the really funny one. And it's kind of like when I was a little kid watching Bosom Buddies and I was just really enthralled with Peter Scolari. Meanwhile, like Tom Hanks is just like waiting to blow up. I just have this like inverse like kind of picker of who's got that star power.
It is a weird thing that he really was just this silent member of Blink-182 and he's outshone all of them. Well, Tom DeLonge is now a UFO truther / researcher.
And I think
some other bands and like a graphic novel or something. And then Mark Hoppus.
That's such a charitable way to talk about him. Yeah, he's a UFO researcher.
He's a UFO researcher.
That's so kind. That is so kind.
I'm trying to get Tom DeLonge to come on this podcast. So I'm trying to be nice. No, I'm kidding.
Oh, okay.
But it blows my mind that Travis Barker is like the biggest star. And he still is making headlines with Kourtney Kardashian and his stupid obsession with the movie True Romance and like recreating True Romance with every woman that he dates or is married to. Listeners at home, if you want to hear more about this, Aaron Hosier, our co-host, went off on our Patreon, which we're posting on the same day this podcast comes out. So if you want more Travis Barker content, head over to Patreon.
It's a really deep dive. She has an encyclopedic understanding really of the Kardashians and of Travis Barker.
I'm looking at our little list of what we need to talk about, and you have Superman listed. Tell us about Superman.
Oh, so I'm not a comic book fan, but I did happen upon this offshoot of the Superman story that started a few months ago called Son of Kal-El, where it follows like the son of Superman and Jonathan Kent, named after his grandfather, Superman's Earth parents. Jonathan was the man that found him in the field. So Jonathan Kent's parents are Superman and Lois Lane, and he's bisexual. And I was like, oh, I want to see what this story is. It's not the first time that they've brought sexuality, like queer sexuality into the comic book realm, but it's part of the Superman story. And so I've just been buying this. The issue 5 came out yesterday, and it's the issue where you get the kiss between Jonathan Kent as Superman's son and his like soon to be boyfriend Jay Nakamura, who is a journalist. But the premise for it is that Superman knows that his son has these special powers, and Superman has to go someplace else in the first issue, so he leaves the entire legacy of Superman with his son. And the legacy is all about helping for media fairness, journalistic freedom, helping immigrants. These are the issues that Superman's son attacks. And what's interesting about it is that they updated the phrase. It used to be like truth, justice in the American way. That's what Superman fights for. Well, his son fights for truth, justice, and a better tomorrow, just to be more inclusive. It's like very heartwarming to read this because it's all about what happens in the world right now. It's very much current. He's a breathtakingly handsome guy, and he struggles with inheriting his father's legacy. But it's what's interesting also about it is that the colorist had an absolute aneurysm over this and quit and said, I'm tired of them ruining these characters. They don't have the right to do this. And then he was like, the fact that they changed it from truth, justice, and the American way. He said, what really pissed me off was saying truth, justice, and a better world. Fuck that. It was truth, justice, the American way. My grandpa almost died in World War II. We don't have the right to destroy shit that people died for us to give us. And it's like, I mean, girl, take a breath. Like, it's not, we're not talking about, nobody's rewritten the Superman myth. Anyway, so it's like, you know, I didn't realize it only takes like 8 minutes to read one of these things. But it's very cute. It's, I don't know, I'm kind of into it. It's the first time I've read a comic book since I was a child. I love that
you're talking about this, Matt, because we never talk about comic books, which is...
Well, it's prohibitive. And it's, again, referencing the Sopranos thing, listening to the two guys that you had on talk about why the ending of the ambiguous ending was so difficult for people is because American culture particularly is against sitting in ambiguity. It needs everything to be so tied up and neatly put in a bow. That's why there's this obsession with canon and everything being correct and in line. And I found that so oppressive and difficult to deal with. It's too much. I don't have the time to go back and read 500 issues of Superman just so I can kind of have a context for this. But I jumped into this, I just happened to jump into it at the beginning of it. And so I'm like, oh, I'm gonna run with this. I've never done it before.
It's anyway. What we need right now. We need a bisexual son of Superman. We need American propaganda deleted from our brains.
When this guy complained and he said, this is going to tank, it's actually received more order. The orders for this issue and this series is overwhelming to the point where I went in on the actual day that it came out and there's a sign saying you can only have one per customer. It's like The Simpsons where the guy's like one per customer, but that actually is what it was. You can't buy more than one of these because it's in such demand. People are so into it. So it's nice. It's beautifully drawn. They always sort of are, I think.
Christian, where did Superman have to go? You said he had
They don't explain it. There. They don't explain it. It's sort of a bit weird like that.
I have to go somewhere and here's my whole legacy for you.
Yeah, they don't explain it. It's sort of a bit, that's a bit weird. You're like, oh, come on. Do you have to leave your family?
Do they explain that Nicolas Cage in real life named his son Kal-El?
Mm-hmm. That is actually, in the preamble.
That giant behemoth of a son.
Yeah. Yes. That's in the preamble for it.
Well, I love this new iteration of Superman. It sounds really, it sounds amazing. Matt, you were recovering from your surgery, but you also took some time off in general and you traveled recently. Somewhere.
Yeah, I went to Las Vegas. My partner was doing some work there. If you have a chance to go, I somehow got tickets to go to see the Magic Mike show. It's a magnificent show. It is directed by Channing Tatum. It is a feminist love letter. It was so smart. I was so happy to go. It was so surprising. And if you're ever in Las Vegas, like just go to see the Magic Mike show.
Channing Tatum is interesting. I forgot that he directed that live version of Magic Mike. He also wrote, to keep it on brand for the show, he wrote a children's book. He is a father to a daughter.
That's right.
The one and only Sparkella.
What?
He was running around Williamsburg and Greenpoint this summer and fall with his girlfriend, Zoe Kravitz. That was interesting.
That's why he was always like doing these live Instagram things while he's riding over the Williamsburg Bridge. Yeah, and I'm like, how did I miss you? I mean, I'm not that I'm on the bridge, but I'm like, you're minutes from me. Where are you?
They were just down the street having brunch from my house.
I'm glad they're having a good time in a neighborhood I can't afford anymore. That I used to live in that.
Enjoy your
price out of.
Thank you so much. Welcome to Greenpoint. I do have to say, I just Googled while you were talking the name of his children's book. And you know how, like, if you search for something, like, I put in Channing Tatum book, but then, like, other searches came up, like, at the top of the Google page, like, and it says, people also ask, ... And then there's, like, four or five questions that you can click in. And one is, what disease does Channing Tatum have? And the answer is Tatum is discussed having dealt with attention deficit disorder.
That's the disease that he has.
The disease.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of things that come up when you Google people, Maggie, I mentioned this in talking about your intro. When you type in your name, Sting photo fills in. So let's tell the listeners more about this photo of Sting. It is majestic. It is.
Okay. Yeah. I'm going to pull it up. I've been doing this bit for 10 years because, oh my God, what am I doing with my life? And
do not know. Stay on it. This is
you
magic.
Need the bit.
Magic.
So when I stop doing this, you'll read about it in the obituary.
Yeah, exactly. fans grew concerned. That would be the phrasing. So the image is a shirtless Sting playing a lute. Is that?
And it looks very phallic. Like it's placed very like he's sitting on his legs. He's doing crisscross applesauce on the floor of this little like bordello or whatever they're at, this little wine cellar that they're in, and the lute's placed very phallically. He's showing off how flexible he is, and then Trudy is next to him doing Warrior Two, the yoga pose, and there's like, you know, like a circular candelabra above them, and it just kind of has this thing where it's like, is this the last thing I see before the chloroform kicks in, or is this the first thing I see when I regain consciousness? You know what
after
I mean?
It's like, yeah.
This is the place where you don't know how you got there.
Is this heaven or hell?
This, it does look demonic in some way, but I thought, okay, she was photoshopped in, but then it's clearly not the case. But then I thought, what if this is actually the resting place? Like when I lay down on a bed to rest, relax, and you know how you have to relax all the muscles one at a time, that's part of a meditative problem. When they do it, this is the poses that they land in. Sting is at his most relaxed, cross-legged, staring into a void, holding a phallic lute. He could not be any more relaxed. And same with Trudy.
Yeah. I mean, they both have this vibe of the couple that like really likes your vibe and sends you a drink at the bar.
There you go. They basically, they are the people, they must have been the people who started, like, that's where that came from.
Yeah.
That's where that vibe comes from.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of curious, so this was a photo for Vanity Fair, and I wonder, like, who the creative force behind this was? Like, was this the creative director's idea for this whole motif, or did, like, Sting and Trudy show up to the shoot and have some ideas?
Yeah, I bet they were like, we're just going to send a photographer, and it's going to be an at-home shoot, but then that's what their at-home life is like.
This is actually what it is like.
They're just, like, in their little wine cave. Like,
how do you say no to them creatively? How did they you show up at a photo shoot and they're like, listen, we're thinking about 65 candles, sort of looks like one of us is going to be sacrificed, Trudy's going to do a bit of yoga, and then Sting's going to sit there, and then everyone's like, no, that sounds terrible, but no one can say it, you know?
I keep thinking of like the assistant that has to light all these candles, like the assistant that's just like lighting, like placing them on the floor, like, no, the line has to be straighter. No, there needs to be a 90-degree angle here. Okay.
Well, then the Trudy's like, the one, she just does, she doesn't get it. She's just not getting it right. Get rid of her. And they fire one of them, you know? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah.
Do we know who took the photo?
I thought it was Annie Leibovitz, but I was wrong.
My God.
Very interesting. It does have shades of Annie L.
I think it's a little cluttered for her, don't you think?
I don't know. Someone touched me.
There's a lot going on. The staging feels very theatrical in an Annie way.
Like, I wonder what they think of this photo. Like, did they look at that photo? I'm like, yeah, that's us. They got it. They got our essence.
Yeah, exactly.
We don't look silly at all.
Well, you use this photo a lot on Twitter, especially. You sometimes will superimpose it. Well, you use it for like reaction kind of images.
Yeah.
But then you also, I enjoyed, you took Mark Zuckerberg's presentation about Facebook changing his name to Meta and you put it in that presentation.
Oh, yeah. No, I do it all. Like anytime like someone's like in Congress has like, you know, like a giant poster board they have to refer to, like that's an opportunity. There's one picture I really like where Peter Navarro, the Trump financial advisor, was like walking out with paintings that weren't his. Like there were some like AP photos of him just like walking out with things that like are supposed to be, like, I think it was like the Eisenhower building. He was walking out of these paintings and like they aren't his. Like they're like government property. What are you doing? And that's why I just superimposed some of the pictures into the paintings he's carrying. Like.
That's amazing. Well, Maggie, because you are such a Sting expert, I thought before we got into our Thanksgiving edition of Daddy Issues that we would play a game with you called, drum roll, please, It's a Sting Thing. Put on the red
line. Oh. Okay, I'm going to do very badly because I don't like really read about Sting. I just look at pictures of him and laugh.
I don't know. Listen, Maggie, there's nothing at stake. There's nothing at stake, and yet there's everything at stake.
Yeah, you know this, what are you talking about? This is incredibly high stakes.
I got a reputation as a Twitter weirdo, don't follow.
Exactly. Okay,
just do your best.
First question, just do your best. What is Sting's astrological sign? I'm going to give you four or five choices. Leo, Scorpio, Sagittarius, Taurus, or Libra?
My first thought was Libra.
You're correct. He is a Libra and his birthday was October 2nd.
Jesus. Sting and my dad are both Libras.
Guess who he shares a birthday with?
No.
Annie Leibovitz.
No. Oh my God.
He also shares a birthday with Lorraine Bracco, who plays Dr. Jennifer Welty on The Sopranos, as well as Gandhi and Kelly Ripa.
There you go. God. What a dinner party.
All right. Wow. You first one down, you nailed it.
Like, logically, I was like, everyone hates Scorpio, so maybe he's a Scorpio.
And,
but then I'm glad I went with my gut.
True or false? Sting has been thinking about death since he was a child.
True.
True. He said in an interview with Rolling Stone, I've been thinking about death since I was a kid. I get a kind of spiritual vertigo. I was brought up in a religious background with ideas of eternity, eternal torment, or eternal heaven, which sounded just as tormented to me. I became obsessed with it, maybe morbid about it.
I feel like that's everyone's experience who grows up Catholic, but he makes it sound like it's his and his alone.
Somehow he was alone with this idea.
It's unique.
Yeah, like, oh, wow. When you're a kid and you realize, like, oh, shit, I'm going to die one day. Like that rocks
and,
every kid. Like,
and then no, but that's it's
all. You're right, Maggie, to think that that's like uniquely Sting.
Yeah, that's like everyone. That's like everyone in like Sunday school.
Yeah. If Sting does not have a cologne currently called Uniquely Sting, he should start one. Uniquely Sting. Okay.
Sting and Sting alone.
So you're Sting and Sting alone. You're two for two here. Sting was described by police guitar player Andy Summers to the New York Post as, quote, a whore, a narcissist of the highest order, not a team player, or someone who needs to take a long, hard look in the mirror.
I would say not a team player.
Yes, three for three. Amazing. Look at you. Oh my God. He isn't a team player because he just split. He left the police to go release a million albums.
But it seems like they were really just irritated, fed up with him too.
Yeah, they hated him. I think they continue to hate him.
Yeah.
True or false, do Sting's children call him Sting?
No.
They do.
Get out. Stop.
In the 1985 documentary, Bring on the Night, a journalist called him Gordon, to which he replied, my children call me Sting. My mother calls me Sting. Who is this Gordon character?
Dude.
That's so weird. And David Bowie's real name is
David Jones.
Yeah, he's like, oh, it's just a character. Like that really healthy kind of, no, it's just a name that I use on stage.
That's what Amon used to always say. It's like, the world knows David Bowie. I know David Jones. I am married to David Jones.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yes, Sting did the opposite. And he is Sting at all times in his life. His real name is Gordon Matthew Thomas Sumner.
Oh, that I know.
Mm-hmm, you knew it. All right, we got two more. You're still doing great. Hang in there.
He's in that Tom Waits pantheon of celebrity that I hate where they're just in character. You know what I mean? No, I'm Sting. No, this is... there's some character all the time.
God. Wow. I also hate Tom Waits. And when people love Tom Waits, it's a huge red flag to me in the same way that loving Charles Bukowski is a red flag.
Yeah, yeah.
Run away.
And people get really upset when you say you don't hey, this just isn't for me. And they get really anytime I mention that, there are dudes in my mentions, sending me a link to the song that's going to change my mind.
Yeah.
I don't know what Tom Waits, I've never heard his music. I don't know what he sounds like.
Yeah. Right.
And I haven't heard enough of it to know it's not for me.
And these are the guys that I know that these guys on Twitter see discourse about, quote, reply guys. But of course, it doesn't apply to them. They're not a reply.
No.
Not at all. Okay.
I have muted over 1,000 people.
So how many are men that you've muted?
like 90% of them.
Yeah.
And it's like my offenses are very like, it's just sometimes it's like when guys like reply to me about something they like, but they tell me like they're informing me, like they assume it's knowledge I don't have.
Right.
Like instead of saying like, hey, do you like this album? I like it. Or hey, have you heard this, you know, seen this movie? I think it's cool. They like tell me like, they do like this little like kind of professor discourse in my mentions, and it's awful.
Yeah. Instead of being like, are you familiar with this song? It's like, you must check out the B-side to this Japanese import version of blah, blah, blah. And you're like, eat shit.
But it's such a total trope. Like, it's such a, like, how do they still do it? It's so, it's like, it's such an obvious, terrible thing to do. I don't know.
I think it's, they still do it because it's kind of like the phenomenon of how are men still, like, how is Andrew Cuomo thinking that Me Too wouldn't apply to him, you know?
Right.
Like,
yeah.
It's just
that sheer force of will and entitlement. Like,
yeah, it's exactly. Well, not me, other guys, but not me.
Yeah.
Okay. Two more questions. Who changed a 10-year-old Sting's life when they waved to him from a car? John Lennon, Little Richard, the Queen Mother, Eric Clapton, or Elvis?
I want to say Eric Clapton because he's awful, and that's kind of a like, that's a really great synergy. Like, it's like, oh, game, like, shit game recognizes shit game. Like, okay, great.
Yeah.
It was actually a close second in the realm of horrible people. The Queen Mother. It was the Queen Mother, allegedly, according to his Wikipedia, Sting said that he was waving to the Queen as she rolled by in her Rolls Royce while he was growing up in his shitty shipyard adjacent neighborhood in England, where he felt that he was doomed and destined to be a dock worker. A 10-year-old Gordon Sumner was, quote, infected with the idea that I didn't want to be in this street. I didn't want to live in this house. I didn't want to end up in the shipyard. I wanted to be in that fucking car.
Okay, that makes sense on like a symbolic level, like this relic of the British Empire and of colonialism coming by and anointing him, this man who gets rich off of music based on reggae.
Yes.
Like this guy who completely appropriates like black music and becomes like this multimillionaire. Yeah.
Yeah.
That all tracks. That all makes sense.
It totally does. Okay.
Yeah.
Last question. Which of these movies or TV shows has Sting not appeared as himself on? Ally McBeal, The Simpsons, Only Murders in the Building, B-Movie, or Dune?
He wasn't himself in Dune.
You got it. That was a trick question. Maggie, was I want to congratulate you on you're an active listener. You got 4 out of 6 correct. That is a B+/A-. So thank you for playing It's a Sting Thing. That was amazing.
Well done.
I was kind of hoping that like the Studio 60 and the Sunset Strip cameo would come up when you were like,
remember that. That's right.
I saw it in Wikipedia and I was like, what did he played himself on Studio
60. Yeah.
He plays himself. He's playing his lute. And Christine Lottie's character, I think she's a journalist, just like that whole show was an embarrassment after embarrassment.
It was so bad. Yeah.
Yeah, that moment in particular, it's like Christine Lottie, she's like slobbering. She can't believe she's meeting Sting.
Yeah.
I'm really happy for Paulina Petrikova. She's moved, you know, she had such a horrible marriage to Rick Ocasek and he was awful to her and he cut her out of his will and it was a whole thing. And cut his children out of his will. But did she have to find love with Aaron Sorkin? God damn
it. Well, it didn't last.
They broke up now?
Yeah, they broke up a while ago.
Oh my God. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
How? Shit.
Ugh. I actually saw the new Aaron Sorkin last night, the new movie being The Ricardos, and the one where it's like Nicole Kidman as Lucy.
Oh, you saw
Lucille Ball. Yeah. And it's like, you know, it's fine. There's brief moments where Nicole Kidman turns her head and it's like, whoa, that's Lucy. But the rest of it, you're like, anyway, sorry.
All right. Well, should we get into it, Matt? We've been gabbing, talking about Sting. Let's get into Daddy Issues Thanksgiving Edition.
Indeed. Woo! And we're, as usual, we start with who is not our dad. And when we say something or someone is not our dad, when that person, place, or thing has recently been infuriating, tragic, cruel, or just a massive disappointment. And Maggie, as our guest, I would love for you to go first. Who is not your dad right now?
Not my dad right now is the Penn Station commute from New York to the greater Philadelphia area. Especially not my dad are the people who use seats on a crowded commuter train to then like have a nice little seat for their bag, for their rolly bag. Mm-hmm. But on a bright side, I perfected a look that's so vicious that people jump and instinctively take the bag off the chair when I look at them.
That's good. That's a skill. That's a good skill to have. So how many times have you had to do this Thanksgiving commute? This is like a regular thing, like a yearly, right? For how long?
I've lived in New York for like 16 years.
And in that time, you've perfected this power. I guess that's
the upside. Or it's just like it's kind of like man spreaders where I'll just like, I'll just like force myself in between. Like I'll just like,
yeah,
I'll just full on go in because I am not, like I'm not, I'm just,
I the seek them out.
I'm like Do Michael Douglas and Falling Down, but like, like a gender flipped version. Like,
do you ever do that? I look for the men who are manspreading and then I go and make them move for me.
Yeah.
Because it drives me nuts.
So Matt and I, for the listeners at home, can see you. What is the look? If I am like, I don't feel like putting my suitcase on the overhead thing. What do you do? What is the look?
Yeah. What's the facial muscle memory thing that's happening?
Well, I walk by and then I meet their gaze and I hold it while I'm going. And I look back from them to the bag, then there's like a movement of them to the bag, them to the bag, them to the bag, their eyes to the bag. And just so there's no mistake what I'm looking at and what I'm pissed off about.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of just like almost swallow my lips like, you motherfucker.
Yeah.
But you don't say anything. It's like a pinter pause kind of thing.
I don't have to say anything. Like sometimes if it really comes down to it, I'll be like, hey, is your bag comfortable? But I'm usually not one to start shit. I'm usually just one to kind of inflict disapproval that's so egregious that they have to react.
The look of scorn. I do that when people are loudly talking on phones. Like I cannot handle the like Metro North phone call. I want to listen in on a conversation that's like funny or scandalous or at least interesting. It's always like about nothing or
someone killing time and asking bland questions that don't need to be asked. Just because they can't be alone for 10 seconds.
If I want to overhear something, I want to hear like a breakup. I just want to overhear like a pivotal moment in someone's
That's
life.
The money shot.
I was, I was on it and it killed me. I was on a Metro North and I was sitting next to, I was sitting like three rows in front of two guys that were like spilling tea about John Stamos. And I could only hear like every other word. And I was like desperate. Like I almost got up and moved, but I couldn't because it was so packed. But somebody had details on John Stamos and I think about it like at least a couple times a year to this day of like, what were they saying? Like whatever it was really good. It was really good information.
What do you think it was?
He's probably like a weirdo. Like, I don't know. Mm-hmm. Remember how he and his like very much younger wife are like obsessed with Disneyland? Not that that means anything. There are people who love Disneyland and it doesn't mean anything.
Yeah.
But like, it was something about him being in a play or something.
Yeah, he was on
Broadway. He was on Broadway for a bit.
Yeah,
he has that vibe of, you know, like one of those actors that ends up on Broadway for a bit.
Yes, totally.
I'm usually stuck overhearing someone, like someone talking to someone who doesn't want to be talked to, like trying to speak. I'll be real. It's the dude talking to a woman, but it's always dudes trying to insert themselves into people's lives. But like I'm usually just overhearing, like, and then the person too polite to really draw a boundary, but at the same time just only giving them one word answers, like trying to telegraph how uninterested they are.
Yeah, like, or like looking at their phone and not really engaging. That's amazing. Well, I have a similar not my dad this week, which is, yours is the commute to New Jersey. Mine is the act of renting a car in the greater New York City area and also driving in New York City.
You have to go like out in the middle of nowhere to get the car. Like,
well, no, I
go to LaGuardia, right?
And I'm not that far from an Enterprise in Greenpoint. There's an Avis, like there's an Avis car rental, like down by like North 6th and Kent. But the process of renting a car is nightmarish and wildly expensive. It's so expensive to rent cars. Like, I have had prices quoted back to me where I'm like, I could fly to LA for cheaper than that. And I'm driving up to see my sister in Ithaca. You know, it's a thin line between love and hate. And sometimes, you know, you just shift things a little bit. Not your dad could be your dad. Driving in the city is both harrowing and makes no sense at all. And also kind of fun. It's kind of amazing because I used to have a backwards where I thought that people in New York City were really good, quote unquote, drivers. You have to really know how to be a defensive driver. No one knows how to drive here. People are just like, there's no rules. You could drive into someone else's lane if you wanted to. You can honk for no reason. You can honk because someone is stopped legitimately at a stoplight to turn. And there's nothing they can do except stop because it's a red light and you still get honked at. none of it makes any sense. I vacillate between being like, oh, I secretly love this because it's so chaotic and like funny and bizarre. But the thing that is the worst is the feeling of coming back into the city and being in a car. And it's like, you know, most GPSs on cars now will tell you, like, or your phone, like, oh, you know, it's 9 miles to home from the tunnel to get back into the city, Lincoln Tunnel or whatever, 9 miles.
It takes an hour and a half.
And it's 90 minutes ETA.
Yeah.
Such a bad feeling. Like, you just want to be in your apartment. You just want to be in your bed. You just want to be home. And you're like, I have to wait. I have to crawl for 90 minutes for 9 miles. Anyway.
The bladder doesn't explode.
I know.
Always, always vigilant that you are, because anything could happen at any time. It's not like you're just sitting in boring traffic like in LA. Like, somebody could kill you at any second.
You literally just crawl for 90 minutes. You crawl. You drive 2 miles an hour for 90 minutes. So mostly I'm facing this because my sister lives in Ithaca and I go up there for major holidays. And Ithaca, you need to get a fucking train. Why don't you have a train? You are... Cornell.
A college town, right? It's a college town.
Mm-hmm. It's a college town. There's no train. It's insane. Anyways, not my dad is renting cars in New York City, even though I secretly love the mess of it all. Matt, tell us.
Not my dad really is just the entire notion of Thanksgiving. I'm actually kind of ambivalent about it, literally, in the sense that I've lived in America for half my life and only really celebrated it half the time. And it's sort of like my relationship with the metric system versus imperial, where I'm just like, half the time I've done this and half the time I've done the other. And now I have no instinct about either of them. But I kind of just like go, I don't particularly like the meal, food. I don't like the dishes. I do eat turkey every day. So it's just like, I'm eating this turkey that I eat like every day anyway. The best part about having a big Thanksgiving dinner at your house is not having it and going to a restaurant. That was one of the best Thanksgivings I ever had, was going to this restaurant around the corner of Williamsburg. And I'm like, I got the Thanksgiving meal. I'm like, this is incredible. It's a third the price. I don't have to clean up. But I don't have to make any of it. I do care more about Thanksgiving than I do about Halloween. I like the fact that it's a huge holiday in America that's secular and entirely about gratitude. We don't have to like endless religion all over everything, but I just don't think I care that much about it. I just don't think I do.
I like Thanksgiving because it's not religious. Like, it's just, let's eat the food.
It's a major selling point for me too.
Yeah.
It's a celebration of gluttony. Mm-hmm. Yeah. What's more American than that?
Yeah.
Look, exactly. No shade, you know, everyone do your thing. I'm not mad about it, but
what
I'm just
like, what is your favorite holiday?
I don't even know.
Yeah.
I mean, I really don't know. I like the first day of summer, actually, because it's like, ooh, summer's going to be, like, summer is fab. I love summer. Because then you go have, like, lobster on the beach and stuff. Like, that's cool.
Are you
cool.
A Memorial Day guy?
I guess so. Yeah.
I'm a big fan of all the holidays where I'm not expected to go home.
Yeah.
The holidays where I can be left the fuck alone if I want. Those are good holidays.
Yes.
And you can just do it anyway. Have you ever spent July 4 by, like, I spent July 4 by myself. Like, I've spent several holidays by myself, and it's actually been over the years. Like, it's actually been like, oh, this is cool.
Oh, yeah, it's cool. Yeah, you chill out. You read. Yeah.
I feel like it's okay to be alone on 4th of July. Like, there's not stigma about, like, oh, you were alone on the 4th, but there is
not, like,
so much stigma about Christmas. I've heard someone describe it as the Trinity of Terror, as Thanksgiving, Christmas, New Year's Eve.
I don't drink. So, but even before I stopped drinking, I never really cared about New Year's, but I'm a really big fan of a New Year's Day party. I have never had a good time at a New Year's Day party.
That's because the horror of the evening is over. And now it's like, oh my God, a new thing. I'll have brunch and people can come over. Yeah, totally. Yeah. I totally agree. Yeah. Let's go in the other direction and talk about who our Thanksgiving-based dads are right now. It's just a reminder that if we decide something or someone is our dad, it means we think it or they have recently shown big boss energy tempered by compassion, intelligence, and or vulnerability. Maggie, once again,
I'm going to piggyback on something you said about going, how you loved going to a restaurant, because every year my mom says we're going to Prospectors, the buffet near my mom's apartment for Thanksgiving. I'm like, yo, that's my dad. For all the reasons that you said, like it's a $20 buffet, so I don't have to dress up. I am not doing any housework. I am not hanging out at an aunt's house. I don't want to hang out at for 8 hours all day. Like, we eat, we pay our check, and we go.
Yeah.
That's the best.
It's so good.
You're with your mom at Prospectors. What is the vibe at Prospectors? Do you have a brother, right?
Yeah. He very wisely always schedules work that night. He's a bartender.
Uh-huh.
That's usually a lucrative night for him, because it's like, what do you want to do when you have to spend all day for family? You want to drink.
Yeah.
And lo and behold, there's my brother ready to take the pain away.
He's helping the community.
So he comes down, and then we have to get him back to Philly on time so he can start his shift at 8. So there's kind of like these nice hard outs that my brother so he's kind of the buffer, so I don't have to handle mom alone. We drop him off, and then sometimes mom and I go to the movies, which can be kind of a shakeup. Like, it's usually a good idea because I can just sit alone for a while. I don't have to I'm not being interrogated. So it's at the same time, we saw The Mule together, I think, one Thanksgiving. And then I had to sit with my mom while we watched Clint Eastwood have two threesomes. The second one was mostly implied, but it was still just
Yeah. Well, you'd live to talk about it. So well done.
Yeah. Thank you, Clint Eastwood. Thank you for this magic holiday.
Yes, thank you, Clint Eastwood. Isn't The Mule, someone was just telling me about The Mule the other day. Like, the premise is what? That he's really a good driver, and so he's just a drug mule?
Sold. Make that movie. Clint Eastwood's a good driver.
Is that what it is, Maggie? Is that correct?
That's the elevator pitch.
Well, there's he's a good driver, and he gets laid multiple times.
Did he write and direct it?
Yes, he did. Well, I know he directed it. I'm not sure if he wrote it, but it's possible. I do like his movies, though. I don't, I'm not aligned with him and his politics, but he does make really interesting movies. Mm-hmm. Like, Richard Jewell was fascinating.
Interesting. I haven't seen that. I did see Gran Torino, which is amazing.
Oh.
It's just like, it's old man fantasy. Like, doesn't he literally say, get off my lawn in Gran Torino?
He might. I know his pants are hiked up really high. I always enjoyed when Bill Hader did his impression of him. Like, his pants were up to his nipples. Like, his belt was up to his nipples.
The inseam is 4 feet. It's the pants enormous.
He did that parody of himself where he was at the Republican National Convention just barking at a chair. Remember that?
Did he do a parody of that, or did he?
No, I mean, I think that, to be fair to him, I think he was clearly doing a bit, interviewing a Democrat who wasn't there on a chair.
Obama. I think he was bitching out Obama.
Oh, he was bitching. Yeah, right.
Forgot about that. I think you're right, Matt, that he was trying to do a bit and it was just really went off the rails. But I don't think
he didn't set it up, And so we're just why? I went wow, I thought I was going to wait till Thanksgiving until I watched an elderly person argue with furniture. But I'm getting it now.
Yeah. If you missed Thanksgiving, here it is at the RNC.
I totally forgot that happened. Oh, my God. Combined with John McCain and Sarah Palin, hell. And
what a treat.
I know.
Please, what have you got?
My diet this year is cranberry sauce. And let me tell you why. Because it's good. It really is. And it really pulls.
Well, that's all we've got.
That's it.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. That was to tell me about your father. It is good. It balances out. You need it. And it gets a horrible rap. It's like a cliche that it's disgusting. And listen, it's not like I'm eating cranberry sauce any other day but Thanksgiving. I admit that. But it does balance the foods on the plate. You know, it helps with the turkey. If you combine turkey with a bite of mashed potatoes and cranberry sauce, it's delicious. It's the perfect bite.
Can I tell you something about this? I eat it almost every day. I have a can of cranberry sauce in my house, and it's my favorite snack is sliced roast turkey rolled up with a tiny bit of cranberry sauce every day of the year. Throughout the pandemic, it was a way that it was a staple, like consistent thing. I absolutely love it.
Does your bodega guy like call you? Are you known as like the cranberry sauce guy to like your bodega guy?
I think so. I think that's.
You come in, you're like, he's like, I've got a fresh one in the back. And he's like.
Yep. But you know what's funny about cranberry sauce too? When you go to buy it at the bodega, they're always covered in dust.
Yeah.
So you pay $1.99 and they're always covered in dust. And then there are sometimes. In the last year when just like Food Town just did not have any, for weeks. Whole Foods does not sell it at all. It's
so
the
when
best
this was
thing
all
ever.
Out, were you like turning over cop cars because you just like couldn't hit?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what I thought.
It was a dark period of time.
You punched a hole in a wall. You're like, Matt, I thought you were being sarcastic at first when you started saying that you do have a little bit of cranberry sauce every day.
No, I'm not kidding. I'm not kidding.
I appreciate that.
No.
My thing about hating on cranberry sauce is like, I just grow, like, you know what I say? I say grow up to people that say that. Grow up.
I don't even hear it. Whenever they start grow talking up. About it, it's just static all
it's
of
like
a sudden.
It's like people that don't like hot dogs or mayonnaise. Like, get over yourselves, of you.
These are different things, but still.
No, they're not. They're all delicious. Well, it's all good. You don't have it. There's sometimes foods, but they're good. So I just, again, I'm going to say that cranberry sauce, you are my dad because you bring everything together on the plate and you balance everything out. And I want to thank you for being there for us.
Yes. And me too. Thank you for your help.
And thank you for being there for Matt and in dusty cans. Dusty cans is my drag.
In the dusty fucking cans of jellied, not the whole ones. I only get the jellied ones because I'm infantile in that way.
Yes.
So my dad, in every year with Thanksgiving, a holiday that I am ambivalent about, but I'm not ambivalent about the state of emergency, the food emergency that descends upon America as Americans go to cook. The Food Network does a full-on live cookathon hosted by Elton Brown with like five of their chefs all cooking. Live, you're just like watching them. It's in real time, so you can just like follow along and not fuck it up. If you panic about your turkey, you can call the turkey hotline that's run by the actual USDA Meat and Poultry Department, the number for which is 1-888-674-6854 if you want to call them. They are government employees who are standing by to help you with your turkey panic. And in the lead up to this day, Martha Stewart, the New York Times, Bon Appetit, Epicurious, they've started this war, this competitive war of like, we have baked 79 different types of turkey so that you don't have to, so that you know the best way to do it. The media mania of like not fucking it up. We've done the work. Pay attention to us. And the fact that people deep fry turkeys, and there will be people who will die this year, as there are every year, deep frying turkeys, death, mayhem, emergencies, media wars. These are the things I love about Thanksgiving.
I love
absolutely.
I love that you gave the number of the poultry hotline.
1-888-674-6854. That's the number to call.
That's such a good point about service journalism, or just, you know, I think the New York Times did a story yesterday that literally was like, Melissa Clark spent the past 6 months perfecting.
Yes. Melissa Clark, pastry or some crap.
They think they're helping, but actually what they're doing is adding a lot of pressure to people to think this is the recipe that was perfected in a laboratory for the past 6 months by Melissa Clark. So if I fuck this up, I can't do anything.
Well, it's also like the thing about cooking is it's just science. Like, I love it. People go to the kitchen and go, well, whatever, I'm just going to do what I feel. People who don't know how to cook do that. And it's like, no, there are scientific rules the way this works, and they either you do it that way or you don't. Yeah. I guess it is like, if you fuck it up, then what's wrong with you? We did 6 months of research.
We did six months, and like, this is the recipe that we have landed on. And I just feel like it's kind of unfair, because you know what that does? It doesn't allow people to fuck up for 6 months perfecting their version of that perfect pumpkin.
And that's what people should be doing. That's the American tradition.
You know what I want?
That's what they should be doing.
I want someone to perfect the recipe for homemade hot dogs and mayonnaise.
I could make mayonnaise for you. It's a blender thing. We'll perfect it.
No, it's not easy to make that.
Sure. Okay. It's not. You can make both in a blender, honestly.
You can make a hot dog in a blender and then you set it and forget it.
Yes, that's exactly right. I will say that what I also love is I've been to multiple Thanksgivings and the dad does nothing to cook. And everyone else does everything and then comes in at the end and just is like, no, we want the turkey like this.
It's true. The gender roles are on fire during the holidays,
aren't they?
It's a lot of football and meat carving for the men, quote unquote, still. Oy, oy. Matt, we talked for so long that our guests had to leave to use the bathroom and come back. So we need to wrap this up.
I was just about to say, let's do that.
Maggie, thank you so much for coming on. It was a joy and a pleasure, and for talking to us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Maggie, so much for coming on, telling us about your father, all of them.
Mm-hmm.
Follow Maggie at Maggie Sirota on Twitter. Tell Me About Your Father was created and produced by Aaron Hosier, Elizabeth Thompson, and Matthew Philp. Follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Tell Me About Your Father, and become a Tell Me About Your Father subscriber at patreon.com/tellmeaboutyourfather.